Movies and Booze on Moncrief.
With Marks and Spencer.
On News Talk.
It is time for Movies and Booze, but just to remind you that it is the day for Make-A-Wish. Makeawish.ie/donate is where you need to go if you'd like to make a donation today. Earlier on in the show, Henry McKean put his body on the line for Make-A-Wish. And in this part of the show, we're going to risk our souls. We are risking eternal damnation because of one of the wines we're going to drink today. Michelle Lawler is here to tell us about it. She's handling it with gloves, just to be on the safe side. They are so-called celebrity wines. The good Brad Pitt's wine, is that
yeah,
right?
We have a Brad Pitt rosé.
That's fine.
Which I'm looking forward to so much. I love it so much. Yeah. And then the other one is Trump's Meritage from Virginia. And you have to remember that no one knows more about wine than Trump.
Yeah.
Even though he doesn't drink.
No, and it's the best wine ever. Everybody says so. Yes.
I laughed because it's got quite a low rating on Vivino and yet it's won loads of medals. So I wonder, does he win based on blind tasting or based on fear?
Yeah, probably based on fear. Probably based on those guys over here. Those other wines are rubbish. It was all fixed.
Fake wine.
Yeah, and if he doesn't win wine medals in, then he arranges to have a riot there instead for outraged wine fans, apparently. Right, so what movies are we going to be talking about today, Chris?
We are going to be talking about Four Mothers, which is a little cosy homegrown comedy from Darren Thornton, who made, do you remember A Day for Mad Mary? All the way back in 2016. So this is the first film he's made since then. About a guy who not only is looking after his own mother, played by Fionnuala Flanagan, but three other mammies because his friends are awful and they've left them with him for a weekend. When he's stressed out in his professional life, as we'll hear. So there's an Irish comedy first and then a Richard Burton biopic called Mr. Burton. But the title also refers to the main Burton in Richard's life because he was Richard Jenkins.
Yeah.
And the guy who taught him how to act and who took him into his home was his teacher and a theatre director named... Philip Henry Burton. So it's all about their relationship, about a young Richard before he became the world's most famous
and
actor.
And who plays Richard Burton?
We've got Harry Lawty from Industry, who is just superb in the role. We'll get to that in a bit. Because you're thinking to yourself, who would want to play Richard Burton? And the voice as well. Yeah, because everyone can do a silly Richard Burton voice and the danger there is that he will just be another one. But he's very good at it. And Toby Jones then is playing the mentor figure. So we're very much in the school of Dead Poet Society, you know, that sort of like, you know, teacher right. that sees something in the student's a bit, you know, needs a bit of taming. It's a little bit like that.
Yeah, I don't think Richard Burton ever actually took to the taming.
No, I don't think
well.
So actually,
really. And CinemaCon's been on where they've no doubt announced a series of completely original film concepts.
I mean, well, actually, now that I'm looking at this list again, there are a good few sequels and further installments, in fairness. But a lot of films that I've been talking about over the last couple of weeks, you had presentations from studios and the likes of Sony Pictures, Warner Brothers, etc., etc. Kind of the ones that seem to have gotten the biggest reactions. You have Freakier Friday, Lindsay Lohan and Jamie Lee Curtis back again. We got new footage for the new Tron movie starring Jared Leto. Elle Fanning teased Predator Badlands, which is obviously going to be the next installment for the Predator franchise. Very excited about this. I know we've talked about this previously on the show. We had Jeremy Allen White and Bruce Springsteen taking the stage to talk about Delivery from Nowhere. He's obviously playing Bruce in this film. I think that's going to be good. And then The Running Man remake as well with Glenn Powell and Colman Domingo got a big reaction in the audience as well. And then the usual, like, Avatar's back again.
So that's one film you've mentioned that actually has any, and that's based on a true story.
Yeah.
I'm not blaming you for that. This is, you know,
I
usual
don't
sad
to tell
shit.
You, we're running out of IP.
Yeah, sad. No one's just. Oh, I suppose they're not prepared to invest in original ideas.
No.
Okay.
No.
People keep showing up for the remakes. That's exactly what we're going to get.
Yeah.
Over and over again.
And Mike White, the fellow who made The White Lotus, is now rowing with the composer of the music. Why?
Yeah. So this is interesting. So Cristobal Tapia de Vere is the composer for The White Lotus, or was in past tense. And he's done this interview with the New York Times basically saying that he's like exited the project over these kind of creative differences that he had with Mike White. Like the theme song has become nearly like synonymous with the show, especially the second season, because it has that like crazy build and it's all a bit crazy. For this third season, they were just kind of constantly butting heads over what the vibe of the song was going to be. And again, I think people remember when season three initially came out, I think people thought they were going to carry over the second season theme because people loved it so much. And then when it wasn't that, there was kind of a bad reaction to it online. He's now essentially saying that, like, he had a longer version of this theme in mind that actually incorporated, like, all the fun, like, ooze that we know from the set. I'm not going to do the theme. Nobody needs that.
The gist of it. Ooze. Yeah. But like, that he wanted,
that he was like kind of texting the producer and saying, look, it'd be great. You know, like the audience was, will love this because it's a callback to the second season, but it is still something new, essentially. And he thought that was going to go ahead. Mike White ended up cutting it. I don't really know if there's much of a story here other than that. Like, Mike White's not going to come out and say anything, but he seems, this Tapia DeVere is particularly aggrieved, so.
But they not have agreed on a piece of music that doesn't really go anywhere, somewhat like the third series of The White Lotus.
It's kind of picking up now.
No, I think I missed, I haven't watched last Monday's one, but mother of God. Yeah. You know, I mean, I was really hoping somebody would arrive and just give everyone a kick up the arse. It would just be entertaining to watch, but you know.
It's taken an awful long time to go nowhere.
And all we, like, I haven't seen last Monday's edition, but like up to that point, that all could have been put into one in the first episode.
I like the interviews that Jason Isaacs and Amy Lou Ward, who's just terrific, that they're starting to give, saying that you could get an entire television show out of what happened behind the scenes, because I didn't know that Mike White was still shooting it the way they made the first season. So the first season was made during COVID. Everybody actually had to live together, in a hotel for 6 months. So that they went ahead and did that again. So the hotel, I think, that they're shooting in, that's where everyone lived for 7 months. And apparently tensions were building. They all started to kill each other. There was a bit of a Big Brother vibe about the place. Show us that instead of the actual...
The behind-the-scenes documentary, please.
Yeah, that would be an interesting series,
I want to see, you know, Schwarzenegger, you know, arguing with his brother instead of, you know, the other thing.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And the other thing was just like completely
gratuitous.
Really. It was strange.
Yeah.
Yeah.
To even put it mildly. Okay, so which wine are we going to do first, Michelle? Are you going to ease us in, or are we going for?
I think we'll end on a positive and do Miraval at the end. So why don't we just go 2 feet in for Trump?
Okay.
Not literally.
Yeah. So this is now. He didn't establish this vineyard. I'm assuming he bought it or somebody owed it to him after a card.
Well, he bought it as a distressed asset. So I feel like that Trump all over it, hasn't it?
Yeah.
Now, it's an interesting one. Look, I just got a text from my other half saying, now be careful, some people like Trump. And I'm like, they shouldn't. But anyway, so he said, look, go easy on the Trump.
But they usually haven't got up at this time yet, in my experience. Yeah, yeah. Certainly on social media, they have to wait until their mother lets them on. And they're down in the basement banging away on their typewriter, hating everyone.
So this wine is from Virginia, and it's 3,000 acres, or the region is 3,000 acres, and it was bought as a distressed asset in 2011, and then in 2012 the whole thing was handed over to the son, Eric Trump. So Donald Trump has actually nothing to do with it, and I think they knew that obviously the presidency was coming, and so they were just divesting Donald Trump from everything. So what's interesting about this wine...
Other than the big label on the front of the bottle saying Trump.
We were just saying, how different are the labels? The Trump one has Trump in big, gaudy gold writing. And the Brad Pitt one, you wouldn't know he had anything to do with it.
Yeah.
And that says it all, doesn't it? And so the grapes in the Trump one are a Bordeaux, typical Bordeaux blend, okay? And he actually makes this wine in French oak, so that will be subject to the new 20% tariffs.
Okay.
Which I'm delighted about.
So to import the oak will cost them, more money.
It's funny, like, even if you think of the 20% tariffs to import, like, your finished French wine into France, but there's also all the other things that gets imported for the Americans to make their wine, like the barrels, like the corks, like the glass, like any farmyard machinery. So the 20%, they're not saving themselves. You know, everyone's going to lose ultimately. So shall we try it?
Yes. Okay.
So I tried this, I have to confess, at 9:30 this morning.
We won't catch fire or anything when we do this.
I wanted to try it early and see how we went, but...
A taste of evil.
It's one of those things where you know in your head, like, you've already decided it's awful because you just don't like them. So I was like, I'm going to try it just in peace and quiet and have a think about it. And what I would say is it tastes better now than it did at 9:30 this morning.
Really?
So it's opened up a bit. But what's funny, there's a lingering yuckiness to it. That's not a technical wine
yeah,
thing.
Yeah, there is.
A bit like him.
A bit like him, a lingering yuckiness. But it's made in 18 months in French oak barrels. And I feel like the person who's going to like this is someone who might like a Rioja. Because it's that big, dry, rich, oaky, textural. The oak is the leading flavour and the fruits are the background flavour. And interestingly, he's called this wine, well, depends on how posh you are, Meritage or Meritage. Okay. Meritage is like a throw towards Hermitage, which is a really premium French wine. And the way the rules are in Europe, like Champagne, you can only call your wine Champagne if your grapes are grown in the Champagne region. Bordeaux, if your grapes are grown in Bordeaux. Hermitage. And there used to be a thing that Americans in California would create a Hermitage, which is the same grape blend. So it's kind of like he's like, you know, squeezing it sideways a little bit.
But so Meritage is just a makey-uppy word.
And you know, it's so good. And that Meritage, I was saying to the guys there, if you go, you know, what's a merit in school? It's 60 to 69%. So he's given himself a C for this.
Okay, all right.
He didn't call it distinctionage.
Mediocre.
Or higher meritage. It's just a meritage. So look, it's topical. My lovely cousin happened to be flying home from the States after we spoke there last week. I said, you don't happen to have any Trump or, you know, can you get us a bottle of Trump wine? And she said, there's actually a bottle of Trump Chardonnay in my fridge that I can't bring myself to drink. Someone bought it as a joke. You can have that. But we'll get you a red as well. So courtesy of my cousin, we have had a taste of Trump. Now, would I buy it again? It's like, it's 50 euro wine.
Well, no.
What? What?
Yeah.
But now, just to point out, you cannot buy this in Ireland. So we're not breaking any rules by saying it costs 50 euro.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, it costs 50 euro in America. And good luck to them. Yeah.
But look, it's one of those things where, like, it's... You know, you're kind of buying into the Trump premium image with his goldness and his meritageness. And he actually produces a champagne. And I looked at it and as a quick like look at it.
And does he call it a champagne?
He calls it Method Champenoise. I had a look. I was like, well, I bet he calls it champagne. No, he doesn't. But what he has totally done is ripped off Cristal. Have you ever seen a bottle of Cristal with the kind of orange foil and the orange and the gold and everything? And it looks like he has gone straight, like how he hasn't been taken to court for like, just taking that iconic gold orangey look to kind of recreate that.
He could say he trademarked the gold orangey look. Oh,
touche. But look, I mean, here we are trying a Trump wine. Would I try another one? I'm sure that Chardonnay is going to get opened at some point, but probably with my yucky face on going, oh, I just want to know how gross it really is, not how nice it's really going to be.
Okay, we did that. Makeawish.ie/donate. And if anyone outside has any kind of antacid tablets, we would appreciate them at this point. What movie would you like to do first, Chris?
We'll go for the Mammy's one, Four Mothers.
Four Mothers coming up after this.
Mom, what are you talking about?
Galway. Medium.
Your mummy was showing us these videos of Maura the medium, and Rosie was saying we should find out if she did in-person mediation. Anyway, we sent her a message on Facebook, and to cut a long story short, she's booked us in for a session at 4 o'clock today.
We just want to know that they're at peace.
Who?
Your daddy.
And Nigel.
And Barry.
I just fancy the idea of a road trip.
We are absolutely not going on a 6-hour round trip to Galway, okay? I have a really important call with my publishers.
Right, that's Four Mothers. So it's kind of a road movie, is it, Chris?
In its final half an hour, yes, it turns into a bit of a road movie. But that's just kind of one part of the story. Although I think with these kinds of stories where someone is looking after a bunch of their, you know, either their own parents or someone else's parents, I think the road trip thing is mandatory. I was actually waiting for that. Like, yeah, someone has to make a sandwich, a flask of tea, and off they go. I think maybe someone missed a trick with this one, because I know there were limited special screenings previews of this film last Sunday in Irish cinemas and in a few cinemas in the UK too, for Mother's Day. But it should have been rolled out nationwide in time for Mother's Day.
Yeah,
like, you'd think that would
so.
Just be, why are we releasing a film about mothers the week afterwards? But look, I don't make the rules. I'm not involved in the marketing. I'm just glad that this thing thing actually does exist, because I do like Darren Thornton's work. He's made this again with his brother Colin, who's a screenwriter, and they're actually remaking an Italian, loosely inspired by an Italian film from 2008 by Gianni De Gregorio. It was called Mid-August Lunch, again about this middle-aged bachelor who is looking after his own mother, but then turns it into a little bit of a business in his apartment block, looking after other people's mothers. That's not quite the story we're getting here. It's different enough to be its own thing, I suppose, and there's an Irish flavour to it. So you have James McArdle, by the way, born and raised in Glasgow, you've heard him there, deserves a medal for his Irish accent.
Okay,
I think it's great. You know, there's a lot of bad Irish accents going around at the minute. I'm not looking at you, Pierce Brosnan, and Mobland.
Yes,
but he does a decent job here. He is playing
actually in Mobland. Does Helen Mirren do a better Irish accent than Pierce Brosnan does?
They've both been watching too much Darby O'Gill. So James McArdle is playing a guy named Edwards. He is a novelist, and he has written a YA novel that looks as if it might actually go supernova. Like, he has American publishers on board, and they're very excited about this project. So excited that they want him to come to America and actually promote the thing. A couple of problems there. One is that Edward, whenever he's done interviews before, and we see him doing a couple of radio interviews from his car, he's useless at talking about himself. He can't quite put into words what the novel is about or what he himself is about. And he has such an interesting story to tell. He might also have a bit of heartbreak. He's a gay man who's living with his mother and her carer. There might be something between the two guys there. But, you know, I won't spoil anything. But in order to actually go to America, he will have to maybe put his mum into a home, because he's her primary carer. She is played by Fionnuala Flanagan brilliantly. Alma is her name. She had a stroke. She lost her voice, but she can communicate, as you heard from the clip there, through a smart device. So there's an awful lot going on. And then all of a sudden, there's more going on, because two of Edward's friends, played by Gordon Hickey and Garrow Farrelly, they're also looking after their mothers. And they just decide one weekend, on the busiest week of Edward's life, to basically drop their mums off at Edward's house, say that, look, we've booked ourselves tickets to a Pride festival in Europe, we're going to be gone for 3 or 4 days, we need this, so you have to look after our mummies. So Edward is freaking out. He calls his therapist, played very well by Rory O'Neill. And Rory O'Neill's character, Dermot, gets it into his head as well. He's also looking after his mammy. He thinks, sure, what's one more?
Yeah.
And he drops his mom off. So Edward...
He's kind of like dogs.
It's insane. And I think that, like, when I was watching it, I just thought, what horrible friends. That is just the worst thing to do to me. And especially, and the whole build-up to them actually doing this... You see him talking to his friends and saying, I am so stressed out at the minute and I don't know what to do about the professional stuff, about my mom. So the fact that they do this horrible, horrible thing to him, burdening him with their responsibilities, is something that I don't think the film can ever really get around, because it's like, oh, this will be okay. No, it's an awful thing to do to somebody. So anyway, he has to look after these four very different women, all with different breakfast, lunch and dinner orders, all with different opinions on everything. And away we go, basically. Bit of a drama, bit of a comedy.
Yeah.
A lot of chaos.
Yeah.
Because
from all of that, you know, what they want you to make you to do is laugh a bit, but have the warm and fuzzies at the end.
Yeah, yeah. There are some more. I think, like, I like this a lot. There is a lot of charm to it. It does have problems. I mean, a lot of the comical sequences in here, you know, if you hold them under a dramatic lens, and this does fancy itself as a drama every now and then, they don't really add up. Like, there's some great visual gags, for instance, of Edward sleeping in his car and brushing his teeth in the drive. Mm. And you're thinking to yourself, well, it's a good visual gag. It's a good idea. Yeah. You can almost hear them coming up with that idea in the room, but it makes no narrative sense. There's no reason for him to be doing that.
Yes.
You know, so it's kind of like that. It's all, oh, these ideas will look great, but they don't really add up into the story. And I just thought every time the film got close to something really powerful and real, it kind of ran away. There's all these conversations, especially when they get on the bus to Galway, about the four mothers. All of them have gay sons who are all around late 30s or early 40s, and there's potential there. And there is some snippets of, like, of, you know, there are some moving moments, but I really think lean into that and the conversations between the mothers and how you know, the conversations then that they had with their sons. I wanted more there, but I think maybe that's a different film. Maybe that's a heavier film. Maybe that's more of a drama than a comedy. But I think the one that we got, it has a spring in its step. It has a smile on its face. I thought the four mammies are brilliant. I thought James McArdle, like, his character sometimes is kind of pushed into so many different directions, but he is superb here. I mean, he's in practically every scene and I think he holds the film up very well. But Fionnuala Flanagan, I mean, she's been doing interviews saying that she doesn't know if she'd do anything like this ever again, because her voice, I mean, she's, you know, she started off as a theatre actress. Her voice is her most powerful instrument.
Yeah,
it really is. She doesn't get to use it here. But at the same time, she's the loudest person in this film, and the character is as well. I mean, her performance, it may sound as though it's a simple thing. It's all just kind of mischievous scales and heavy sighs and knowing looks or whatever. That's very hard to do for the full 90 minutes. And I think she does it brilliantly. And it's so moving, like without using her voice, it's such a just a real thoughtful, soulful, tender performance. And the two of them work very well together. So I liked it. There are problems. I don't want to be too pernickety about it. But don't go into it all cynical. Enjoy it for what it is. And please, Darren Thornton, make more films.
Why did they go to Galway?
Where did they go to Galway? They go to Galway to visit a medium that might potentially, played by Niamh Cusack, that might potentially put them into contact with their husbands. Again, it's one of those ideas like, oh, let's send them off and they might get it, you know, they might have a conversation with the ghost of their husband. It's kind of a silly idea. The film doesn't need it. There's enough
random
in there.
Yeah.
It is, yeah. The film is sometimes made up of all these kind of goofy, random moments. I wasn't really buying that section, but I liked the relationship. There would have been actually enough between Edward and his mum Alma. Go for them. There is enough there, I think.
Yeah. Okay. Fair enough.
Bring your mommy to it this weekend.
Bring your mommy to it this weekend. So Michael Jackson is going to split in two. Now, I don't mean his corpse. I mean the movie about him is going to split in two.
The biopic, that we've again been talking about over the last couple of months. So that's due to be released October 3rd. But basically, there are issues because Antoine Fuqua's film is like it's racking up at nearly 4 hours at this point. So again, obviously that. Who's going to go see a 4-hour movie about Michael Jackson? Super fans might, not sure about the general public. Also, one thing that we've been talking about over the last couple of months is because the Michael Jackson estate is so heavily involved in this, like Jafar Jackson, his nephew, is playing Michael Jackson. Mm. Talk around how they were going to handle the many allegations against him, and it seemed like it was going to be a very sanitized biopic in that way. But actually, as it turns out, they are covering the accusations of molestation against him from the 90s by the family of the then 13-year-old Jordan Chandler. That was settled out of court, no admission of guilt, whatever. But they are actually, that is going to be covered in the film. But they're basically having, the team and the estate are having issues as to how it's being covered in the film.
Yeah.
So it means, like, that's causing delays. It's also leading to reshoots, which is causing delays. So I would imagine it is going to be delayed, not confirmed. But if it makes it to October 3rd, I would be very surprised. Especially, let's say they manage to wrap that up in a nice, neat little bow and they agree on a vision for this really, like, obviously dark subject. You're talking still about 4 hours of material. Like, you know what I mean? With all the whinging about The Brutalist from earlier this year, that came with an intermission. That's not going to get bums in seats, like, even the curious.
I wouldn't be surprised. And they do the first half, and then right at the end of the first movie, they go, and you know, these allegations have come in, end of movie, and then you go to see the second one to see how they treat it.
Yeah. And then it's everything post, and this up to this is it and his death. Yeah. I imagine. Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, that might be. Might be quite cynical, actually. Just to remind people, earlier on in the show, Henry McKean literally risked his physical well-being in trying to get on as many underpants as he could in the course of a minute. He nearly got to 12, but took a nasty fall. 45 seconds in, we're on to our 10th pair of pants here. Another pair of greys, down to dark greys now. We're on to underpants number 11 at 53 seconds, 54 seconds. Chance for underpants number 12. These are the blue ones, on they go. Oh no, he's nearly close. Oh, he's taking a tumble. And the minute's over. And 11 pairs of underpants, Henry. Okay. And possibly an injury sustained there as well.
The last pair I put on back to front and...
If you enjoy men putting on underpants in a hurry, makeawish.ie/donate is the website to visit. If you'd like to help the Make-A-Wish Foundation, help make wishes come true for kids who are struggling with various diseases, makeawish.ie/donate.
Newstalk's Cash Machine.
So congratulations to Peggy in Galway, €154,000 better off as of that phone call. And Peggy, if you're listening, makeawish.ie/donate. Keep that in mind for today. Right, let's celebrate Peggy's success with a taste of Brad.
Cheers, Peggy. Yum. Yeah. So we are trying some of Brad Pitt Rosé, which has been on the market since 2012 and would have originally been Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie, obviously subject to all that controversy. But the Chateau is Chateau Miraval. And Miraval is a Chateau that's been there since 1841. It has been sold a number of times and it was left abandoned for a couple of years. And seemingly in 2008, when Angelina Jolie and Brad Pitt moved in, and they had like, you know, you can stay there and, you know, kind of buy into it after a certain period of time. And I feel like once they bought into it, it was the end of their relationship.
Oh no, is that what killed them?
Oh, I hope not. It's so delicious.
I thought it was his drinking and all the kids.
And all the anger and abuse. So anyway, look, this is from a village called Karen, which was France's first 100% organic village. So everything, fruit, vegetables, obviously grapes there. There's four grapes in this. It's a very typical Provence style rosé. Has everyone had a taste?
Yeah, no, yeah. It's lovely.
It's very nice. Absolutely delicious. And the style of this is actually called gris, which is obviously badly pronounced French, G-R-I-S. So grey, because it's so light nearly that it looks like it's see-through. And I oftentimes, when I'm describing rosés to people, because people think, okay, if it's really dark, it must be sweet and gross. Like, do you remember those old Rioja rosés that were sugar syrup? Yeah. Like, they're so out of fashion now. In actual fact, Whispering Angel, which is probably the most famous version of all of this, was the one that kind of put this Gris style on the map. But the repercussion of that was that everyone subsequently started making these really light Gris style rosés. So even if you were to buy like a Rioja rosé now, which was those gross pink ones, they're this colour. Like, that is the style. Dry, light, elegant. I would oftentimes describe the Miraval rosés. They're kind of like the Chablis of rosé because they're dry and elegant and texturally like really, really delicious. And if you have a look, the wine that we have here is the Studio by Miraval. So the Chateau was actually where a lot of people, there's a music studio there. So AC/DC recorded some music here. Wham! I have a list here. The Cranberries. And Pink Floyd recorded part of The Wall in this studio. So there's a huge legacy to it. And I think when you talk about celebrity wines, like, why would you bother? The ones that seem to do really well are the ones that are in that premium market and the ones that own the property and they're really into like protecting the legacy, investing in it. Mm. So look, I think it's just a really, really delicious glass.
Does he still own it then?
Yeah, there are like two pictures of Brad Pitt with this wine because he really doesn't put his face on it. But he owns not 100% of it. Angelina Jolie sold her percentage to Stali Vodka, but to one of their like subsidiary companies, which is a wine company. So he is like the main celebrity face behind it. I don't know operationally, I mean, are Stali involved in how the contract went? And it's funny, when that kind of controversy happened, there was all this, oh, their divorce is now, you know, everything is in flux. But there was never any press about how it was resolved. So even today, like when I was researching, it was like, well, what actually happened in that? I think Stali Vodka owns whatever Angelina Jolie's percentage of the wine.
Right, okay.
Yeah, which kind of wouldn't fill you with joy. Although Trump's wine is obviously less joyous.
No, indeed. Well, I mean, it was, you know, yes, half Brad Pitt, half Russian. You could taste the Russian in there.
Yeah, oh yeah. Yes. Well, it's funny actually because the key winemaker in here is a guy called Marc Perrin, and the Perrin family are one of the best Chateauneuf du Pape wine like producers in all of France. They're like top 10 winemakers. And so when they started this project, like they really invested in, okay, I want to make something that is amazing. So they hired one of the best winemakers. And so the first rosé was released was 2012, the Chateau Miraval. And that was the first time a rosé was listed in the top 100 wines of the world.
Huh.
So the quality is really, really high. When I say it's a Chablis of drinks, of rosés, it definitely is. I was laughing. One of the French newspapers called it the world's best Provence rosé. And I'm like, you just mean it's the best Provence rosé, not the world's best Provence rosé. But like the quality is there. The wine is delicious. And if I was going to drink anything tonight, it'd be that.
Okay. All right. If she was going to drink anything tonight, I suppose you'd be going to the gym.
No.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Right. Meryl Streep might be Aslan, not the band.
She might be Aslan. The Lion, potentially. Yeah. So Greta Gerwig is working on this Narnia trilogy for Netflix, and Meryl Streep is in talks to take over as the voice of the talking lion who lives in Narnia. And I did not realise it was an allegory for Jesus, according to C.S. Lewis's vision.
Of course, he was a bit Christian-y. Yeah, he was. Yeah.
Didn't realise that, but anyway, there you go. I would say, given this that this is being reported, it's essentially a given, but it's not confirmed, I should say. Taking over from our own Liam Neeson, obviously, who voiced it in the most recent adaptations, which aren't even that recent now. We're probably looking at like 10, 15 years ago. So this first film is actually looking at the sixth book in the Chronicles of Narnia series. So it's like the origin story for Narnia. The book was called The Magician's Nephew. And it looks at how Narnia was discovered by Diggory Kirk and Polly Plummer. and discover this magical world through Diggory's uncle's magic. And they're looking at Daniel Craig, I think, to play Diggory's uncle. And then also lots of reports around Charlie XCX playing the White Witch. So that's already an incredible cast for the girls and the gays. We will be lining up to see, well, it's on Netflix, we'll be lining up to our own to see it.
Yeah, queuing outside our televisions to watch that. So, okay, yeah. That sounds interesting. Is it Meryl Streep in a, you know, a lion outfit or is
no,
this,
I would,
is
it's, this... it's good CGI voice, like yeah, gravitas.
Yeah, I would love that.
I'd pay good money to see that.
Yeah. And they've said apparently like it's 100%
be like a cat's kind of scenario.
It's 100% going to be a woman, whether they end up going with someone else in the end, but I would say it's nearly definitely going to be Helen, Meryl Streep even. So
yeah, have you seen the trailer for The Naked Gun?
I have. I
liked it.
It was like drinking Donald Trump's wine and not entirely hating it. Feel dirty.
The OJ line.
The OJ line was good.
Fabulous.
It was good. But hopefully that's not the only joke in the entire...
That's probably the best joke in the whole film.
Yeah, that's the thing. That's coming in October, I think. So,
yeah. No, but it's good at least that it's a son. They're not like just remaking the whole thing.
Yeah. But they'd have to. Like, how could... Do you know what I mean? Like, the shoes are too big to fill. Like, you know?
Yeah.
So.
Is Leslie Nielsen alive?
I don't know.
We discussed this with Brian about a month ago.
Leslie Nielsen, if you're listening,
give us a text there.
Please let us know. So there is going to be a Nine Perfect Strangers season two. They took their time.
Doesn't this feel like 8,000 years ago?
Yes,
this is
it
so
does,
COVID
yeah.
frozen in time.
Or like 90,000 Meryl Streep series ago.
So this is coming back in May. With two new episodes, May 21st, Nicole Kidman coming back as Masha, the enigmatic wellness guru who brings people to the absolute brink. All-star cast this time around. You've got Henry Golding, Christine Baranski, Lucas Englander, Murray Bartlett, Mark Strong, Annie Murphy, I should say, as well. They're heading to the Austrian Alps this time, where, again, Masha is trying to help people discover themselves and all that jazz, but she's actually going to take them to the brink. And Nicole Kidman has come out, because obviously one of the critiques of the first season was that she's supposed to be Russian. And well, there are a lot of critiques for that first season but her accent is kind of all over the place. She's tried to explain that away by saying that like Masha travels and like she's very well travelled and that's why she's not really Russian all the time. I don't know. Again, I'm kind of, as you said, it's been such a long wait in between this, and there's so much, like, it's so... There's so many shows of this vein already that I'm just kind of like, I can't see anyone.
No, well, that's the thing. I would have thought like diminishing returns. And like, she seems to be, like, because she's seems to be involved in all these shows as a producer as well as an actor. So.
Yeah. And again, it was just a thing of like, a lot of people watched it, but did a lot of people watch it because of COVID? You know what I mean? That doesn't necessarily mean it was good.
Yeah.
You know? And I think it was supposed to be, it was based on a book of the same name, but I'm pretty sure it was supposed to be a limited series. I'm pretty sure it was supposed to be one. And then because loads of people watched it because we had nothing else to be doing, they were like, okay, we'll do another one then. And it's getting a bit, it's very White Lotus-y in the sense that like, we'll change the scenario and it's the, you know, another starry cast, but now we're in the Alps. Now we're in a cold place. Now we're in a hot place. Now we're in another cold place. You know what I mean?
And someone dies.
Inevitably dies.
Tell surprise.
Yeah.
I do think the whole eat the rich superstar satire genre is just, it's just too, it's over, it's overdone at this point. Yeah. And Nicole Kidman's involved in an awful lot of it as well.
Oh,
Just take a break from that.
Leslie Nielsen was on to us to let us know he died in 2010. Thanks, Leslie. We appreciate that. Right, let's move on to our second movie of the day. It is Mr. Burton. Here's a clip.
I shan't have this family falling short any longer.
Mr. Burton, I want to be an actor.
To be an actor, you will need to move in certain social spheres.
Bring it to your mouth.
I would like you to scream.
Everything all right up there, is it?
Yes, thank you.
There's a new scholarship to study at Oxford University.
The boy's name is Jenkins. It was his burden. It will inevitably lead to questions.
Adopt me.
There you go. That's Mr. Burton. I suppose just even from that clip, when he was a young fella, he had a Welsh accent.
He did, yeah. So, he was brought up in Port Talbot, mining town in Wales, in the late 30s, early 1940s. And the film checks in on him around 1942, when he is still in secondary school. And he's living with his sister at this point because his father, who's a miner, is just a total waste of space. He's a drunken lout. Every time he kind of sees his son, he doesn't recognize him. You know, Richard might walk into the pub and he'll say, "Who are you?" So that's the kind of sort of relationship he has with his parents. So he's living with his sister, but unfortunately between herself and her husband, like, they can't really afford to put him up. So he's looking at having to drop out of school and get a job. And that would be an awful shame, says his teacher, Philip Henry Burton, because he spots something in the young fella, despite the fact that, you know, he's a bit of a messer in class and that he's kind of more interested at first in, you know, sports, rugby, especially, than academia or, you know, the works of Shakespeare. When Richard gets a punishment one day for handing in, you know, tattered homework, it's to recite a passage from Hamlet. And when he does it, he learns it so fast and he's so good at it. And he tells his teacher, you know, "I bloody love that. Like, this is easy. That's not much of a punishment." So, yeah, so it's one of those things where the teacher sees something and he's like, "I'm going to take this kid under my wing and I'm going to teach them how to find their voice and find that, you know, magnificent Richard Burton voice." And he encourages him to join a theatre circle to learn as much about Shakespeare as possible, teaches him everything about, you know, projection, about, you know, how to sit up straight, stand up straight, you know, project himself on stage. But he also crucially invites him to move in with them, going to the Philip Henry Burton character, that is, or PH, as all of his students call him. PH goes to Richard's sister and says, "Look, I think there's an opportunity here to, you know, I think he might have a really bright future. You know, we're going to get him to go to Oxford, you know, he wants to become an actor." And she's like, "Yes, he has to do something. He needs to do something other than stay here," basically. But it's after he moves in with PH and PH's landlady. The landlady character, I think, is a fictional creation played by Leslie Manville. But she's kind of there to kind of say what we might be thinking, which is that people would talk just about this man who lives by himself, who kind of invites one of his students to move in. And the film kind of, I don't want to say flirts with that idea, but it never really kind of confronts it properly. It's more just like there might be whispers in the street when Richard starts living with his teacher. And then later on in the film, of course, like Mark Evans, he sets out to make this film about Philip Henry Burton, but obviously he's obsessed with the Richard Burton figure, as we all are. Mm-hmm. So there's 40 minutes at the end of this 2-hour film, which are completely devoted to, you know, Richard as a stage actor. We do get to see the Richard Burton figure. I thought this was very good. I mean, it's very neatly packaged. You know, it deletes various characters from Richard Jenkins' life. It kind of just ties up things a little too neatly, leaves out a lot. And you will come away with maybe a dozen or more questions about PH. You know, put it this way, it prioritises one Burton over the other. Yes, because it got to a stage where Philip Henry wanted to adopt Richard Jenkins and he also gave him his name. But I'm okay with, you know, it prioritising Richard because he is such a fascinating figure. And I quite love that final third when you do get to see him become Richard Burton. I think the film does this very clever thing at the beginning where when Richard is... He's joking about potentially finding his voice one day, and he's got that really playful Welsh, you know, small town accent, and he talks like what he thinks a proper English actor would talk like, not knowing that one day he will talk like that. Sorry for that Richard Burton impersonation, by the way. And he goes back to being just Richard the Kid. And then we see over the next 80 minutes that gradual process of him becoming Burton. So there's no sort of whiplash moment where it's like, "Oh, hold on, how is he that all of a sudden?" And I think that transformation is extraordinary. And it takes a brave actor to do that, to say yes to playing Richard Burton. But I think Harry is just brilliant here. I very much look forward to seeing what he does next, because I've just kind of watched Industry. I've kind of dipped in and out of Industry. I don't know whether you've ever watched it.
Yeah.
And dipping in and out of that show is not a good idea. But he is terrific here. I thought himself and Jones made for a lovely duo. It's flawed. I would like to, again, I came away with so many questions, but you know what? It's a perfect Sunday afternoon film.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
I don't mean that in a bad way.
Okay.
But look, if it rains this Sunday afternoon, go see the Richard Burton biopic in cinemas. It's quite lovely at times.
Okay. All right. Fair enough. And so tell us, what is The Husbands? Be Still My Beating Heart. Is this actually an original concept on Apple TV Plus?
So The Husbands is the best-selling debut novel of Holly Gramazio. She's an author and a games designer, and Apple TV Plus is now adapting it for their streaming service, and it's going to be starring Juno Temple, who people will know from Ted Lasso on Fargo. It's going to be 8 episodes. And basically, it's this idea that she comes home to her flat one day and there's a fella there. She's never seen the fella before. Ends up being her husband. And then the husband goes up to the attic and is replaced by another husband. So there's all these husbands coming out of the attic. Fake. What a problem, says someone at home. But yeah. It's very
is it the same husband being kind of... being a recycled kind of thing, or different husbands?
A new husband, as far as I'm aware. Yeah, so I actually have the book at home, and this has given me kind of the thing to read it. But it's very Severance-esque. We're doing a lot about doppelgangers and stuff like that. But I think this is going to be really good. The lead writer on it is Miriam Batche, who's done Succession and Beef. Incredible. And as she signed up for this, they're basically, it's been confirmed that she more than likely is coming back for Ted Lasso, but she's still negotiating it, because obviously the issue with the last season of Ted Lasso, among others, was that Keely wasn't in it enough because she was shooting Fargo. But I think because these are for the same network and stuff, they've basically said that it's like, if she signs on, the scheduling won't be an issue and Keely will be there. But I think it's a money question. So
yeah, okay. All right.
One to watch out for, I would
one
say.
One to watch out for. It might be interesting. That's our lot for today. Thanks to Fionnuala, Chris and Michelle.
Movies and Booze on Moncrief.
With Marks and Spencer.
On News Talk.